This morning we're into the second lesson in our series on the writings of the New Testament. There's 27 of them, four that we call Gospels, one that is an account of the history of the at least part of the first century church and the spread of the gospel. Then 26 letters, some majority of those written by the Apostle Paul, starting with Romans and going through the book of Philemon. Then other letters, and maybe even one that we wouldn't call a letter, more of a book, Hebrews. And then closing out with a book of prophecy called the book of Revelation. 27 documents. And for the sake of this series, and to direct our thinking in a certain way, I'm calling this series the Jesus documents, because that's what they are. They are our primary source of information concerning Jesus, in whom we believe and in whom we put our trust, for which we exist as a church and for the things that we've done already this morning and will be doing as long as we assemble together because of Him and what is written about Him in these 27 documents. Now, last week, as a beginning, we talked about the steady barrage of criticism, accusations, and ridicule sometimes even that is heaped upon these documents by those who do not believe that they have anything of great value in them. Some of these are from other religions. Some of these are those who have no religion, what we would call atheists or agnostics, skeptics. Then there are a great number of those who may profess some kind of faith of one kind or another, but essentially they're not believers in Christianity, or at least they're opposers of the fundamental Christian values that we hold dear, which were held up by Jesus and by those who followed Him, as we read about them in these 27 documents. Now, everyone, I think, will acknowledge that the real crux of the issue with this whole thing about the Bible, particularly the New Testament, is whether or not these documents are actually accurate historical record concerning Jesus and the early church. To put it in other words, can we believe what we're reading here? That's where most of the charges come from those who are critics. And then out of those charges that Jesus didn't really say these things, Jesus didn't really do these things, most of the things that Christians believe concerning Him from His virgin birth and the foretelling of His coming through prophecy all the way through His resurrection and ascension back to heaven, they will argue did not really happen, that they're not true. Therefore, the emphasis of the Christian upon having certain set of values and morals and trying to not only live those in their own life, but in some degree impose them upon the culture around them is misguided and wrong, because you can't trust the very source from which they came. And we, on the other hand, argue and believe that these documents are telling us that God came to earth in Jesus, that He was foretold, that He was born of a virgin, that He did grow up, He did do miracles, He did say these amazing things that we believe. He was crucified, and He was raised from the dead 3 days later. And after some 40 days, went back into heaven and is there now, seated at the right hand of the throne of God. And because of that, He is different than any other person who's ever lived. And the things He taught and the things He said and the things that He told us to do must be listened to in the same way we would listen if God Himself spoke from heaven and we heard His voice. That's a big difference in point of view, isn't it? Between what we as Christians believe concerning Jesus and these documents and what those who do not believe say. So how do we resolve this issue? First of all, we need to realize you're never going to present an argument or evidence or anything else that's going to convince everyone. But all we wish for and ask for is a fair hearing about why we as Christians believe this. Now, I acknowledge and I know that not all of us particularly feel competent or qualified to lay out all the arguments in favor of believing that these things are actually true. But I think it's very important that all of us know that such evidence and arguments do exist, and the material in which those arguments and so forth are found are widely available to anyone to examine. And all we ask is for the hearing. Of course, how things tend to work in the public, and it's not just modern media, but it's always been this way. People will shout loudly about something long enough that people end up believing what they're saying, even if they don't have evidence for it. And we're not shouting very loud. It's usually those who are far beyond doubters, those who are actually unbelievers, who are doing so much of the shouting and who are getting a lot of attention. And therefore, people come to believe, well, they must be true, even though they haven't even presented real evidence for it. Let's consider, first of all, how some of this argumentation works. What are some of the claims that the critics make? And I do wish to point out, and this is easily documented if any of you wanted to go check it out, most of those who are the vocal critics of the reliability of these New Testament documents and the record that they represent and question most heartily the truthfulness and the historical nature of it are people who are not experts in that field. They often are leveraging their great position in another field. They may be an astrophysicist. Now, what do astrophysicists know about historical records? No more than you or I. They may be a physicist. And what does he know about history and how we determine if something is really history or only myth and legend? He doesn't know any more than you or I do. And yet he will be a very vocal critic of the Bible and go around collecting large fees to speak to audiences to tell them this is not believable and this is not true. So most of the critics who actually criticize the Scripture, the Bible, the New Testament in particular, the Jesus documents, are not even experts, not even good amateurs at knowing anything about history and historical documents and what is considered by those who are scholars in that field acceptable proof or evidence that something is or is not reliable and historical. So that's a little thing we need to know right off the bat. So when you hear about someone like Sam Harris, who's a prominent atheist who's constantly attacking the Bible, or Richard Dawkins, a prominent atheist who's constantly attacking the Bible, this is not their field. Now, if you wanted to get into a debate with Dawkins about physics, that's a different subject. He probably could amount pretty insurmountable arguments in favor of some of the things he believes in the area of physics. But he doesn't do that well when he's actually arguing loudly and long about the unreliability of the New Testament. For that's not what he knows anything about beyond just his prejudice. Something else we need to realize is that often those who criticize are not united among themselves and sometimes aren't even consistent with themselves in some of the arguments they present. Let me give you a little example of this. You will hear many say that if Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are records of eyewitnesses, they can't be trusted. What? We can't trust eyewitnesses? And their argument goes like this. We can't trust eyewitnesses because they bought into the image, the picture, and so forth of Jesus, and so they had this vested interest in promoting this image or this idea of who Jesus was, and they were a conspiracy. They worked together as those who had originally seen what really happened to change the story and to put out a story that's different than the real facts. But then they'll turn right around and in other contexts say, these aren't the records of eyewitnesses, but by people who lived hundreds of years later and so couldn't know what the real facts were. Well, that's a real contradiction, isn't it? On the one hand, you say you can't trust the eyewitnesses, but then on the other, you say you can't trust those who were not eyewitnesses. Well, who can you trust? Well, obviously nobody from their perspective. So they're often inconsistent in their arguments. Another part of their inconsistency is they will hold these records to a far different standard of how we know they're true or not than they would hold any other record or document. Here's a little one I've been rolling around in my head for a while. I'll pick on Mr. Dawkins. He's easy to pick on because he likes to be a big target. He seems to thrive on controversy, and he wants you to talk about him whether you're saying good things or bad. Well, I hope I'm saying particularly neither, but just making an observation. He's written quite a number of books. If I were to go down to the bookstore and buy a book by him, it would be easy for me to say, how do I know he really wrote this? It's not the original. I don't have the actual handwritten or typewritten original document. And I could say, I bet that between the time he wrote that first handwritten copy of this book until this copy I have, printed by a printer in a publishing house somewhere, that all sorts of changes were made to it. So this is not a reliable copy of this original. How would he answer that? Well, right now he may say, look, I've got the originals. But what would happen 100 years from now after Mr. Dawkins is gone and his estate passes on to others, and maybe those who receive that estate and then those who receive it from them may decide these originals aren't of any value. After all, we got these tens of thousands of copies out here that were made of this in printed form. So what do we need the original for? And so it'll get disposed of, or it'll get lost, or it'll be destroyed in a fire or disaster of some kind. And then 100 years from now, someone takes that same book and says, this is not what Dawkins really wrote. This is a copy of a copy of a copy. And it would be, because I know how the publishing industry works. That's something I work in. You start out with someone's original notes from which they create an original document, whether it's in written form or these days on a computer. And then from that, it goes to an editor who goes through and finds the typographical errors and obvious other kind of grammatical mistakes that might be in that, and at the same time often is double-checking the facts to make it historically or otherwise accurate. And then it maybe goes up to a publisher who then has his own editor look at it, and it gets changed and edited some more to make it be something they think would be sellable if they did publish it. And then it goes back to the author, and he looks at all their changes, and he probably makes some more changes. Some he approves, some he disapproves of, and maybe he even rewrites something because he's had second thoughts about some of it by then. Already by that time, we're already at four copies from the original. And then finally, that comes back to the publishing house and goes through an editing process, usually one more time, and then it's set to type, and a few proof copies are made, which goes back to the author, and he checks it once more, and any other changes made. And then finally the book is published, and it goes out on the bookshelves at bookstores and on Amazon.com, and people buy it. Then after a year or two, they do a revised edition of it because there's still some errors they find in it or some changes that need to be made after that, and the revised edition comes out. But would anyone question 100 years from now that this printed, published copy that says it was written of this book by Richard Dawkins is not essentially identical to what he originally had in mind when he first wrote it? No. Everybody, I think, and in fact, we do that all the time. We think that when we go out and buy a book of fiction by a prominent author, it's maybe one of your favorite authors, and you're reading it, you have every confidence this is essentially what that author wrote to start with. Even though it's gone through all sorts of revision and editing processes and so forth, actually more processes than we have reason to believe the New Testament documents did. But you still believe it's by them. And that's not only true of works of fiction, but it's true, as in the case of Mr. Dawkins, on nonfiction. If you discount the books he write about the Bible that are definitely fiction. But when he's writing on his field of expertise, then that's nonfiction, it's science, and we have every reason to believe this is essentially what he wrote and what he said, even 100 years later, even after all those copies in between the original and the final. But then when we suddenly come to the pages of the Bible, people say, well, because we don't have the originals anymore, we don't have that one document that at the end of it says, by the Apostle Paul, and we know that's his signature, and we know this is his handwriting, then we can't trust these copies we have. Why not? What is the evidence, the real proof, that these are not essentially identical to the originals? Yes, we know, because we have so many copies of them, that sometimes as copies were made, sometimes a word might be misspelled. Rarely, a word might actually be left out, or even a slightly different word used in place of some particular word. And there's plenty of evidence of that. We're not denying that at all. But did it change what the author said? Over and over, the scholars in this field, even if they're not believers in Christianity, will say, these are highly reliable, attested documents of what the originals must have said. But the critic will often say, well, let's use some common sense here. And of course, most of us know common sense isn't nearly as common as we would wish. But they'll say, appealing to supposedly people's common sense, but who really don't know very much about how documents pass down through history, they'll say, let's consider some things. They said, first of all, there's very little we can know about what happened 2,000 years ago, anywhere, anytime, to anybody. They'll say, that's just common sense. Okay. Secondly, they'll say, and when we talk about something like the books of the New Testament, these documents were written by ignorant, superstitious, unsophisticated people who cannot meet any kind of modern criteria or demands for truth and accuracy. We even quoted from Dawkins, I believe it was, or either him or Harris, just last week, who said these people were so backward by comparison to us that they would have considered a wheelbarrow the very epitome of future technology. You see how they're saying common sense tells us these people aren't qualified to write on a subject as important as history and what really happened. That's what they're saying. They'll say we don't have the original documents. That is, we don't have the first copy made by Matthew or Mark or Luke or John or Paul. All we have are copies, and almost surely copies of copies of copies of copies, and not even the first copy from the original. And surely they've been changed. Common sense tells us that, you know. And these handwritten copies means that they've been edited. They've changed the stories. They've inserted new material. They left out things that would show that the person or the events they're writing about didn't happen just as later believers wanted it to appear that it did. And in fact, those who were doing all of this writing and editing and changing and so forth lived long after the originals and long after the original eyewitnesses. And so there was no one around to point out that they were not telling the truth on this matter. Therefore, because of all of this, according to their common sense, we cannot know much of anything about this person named Jesus. Many of them will in fact argue we don't even know if he was a real person or if he actually really lived, much less know anything about his birth, his life, his teachings, or his death. If all of that is common sense, then clearly common sense says Christianity and most of what it holds to is bogus and fictional. But what sounds like common sense, by their way of arguing, does not match up with the actual facts, nor with what historians and experts in the field of history and historical documents and writings from ancient times tell us. Not just in the areas concerning the Bible, but in any area. John Warwick Montgomery, who's a noted lawyer, professor at the University of, I forget which one, I'm sorry, in England, even at this time, now in later life has become a rather prominent theologian, which means he writes also on the subject of religion and faith, and a prolific author, having written over 50 books last time I checked. A man who has 11 earned college degrees in almost every field imaginable. This man is a genius. Now, I realize just because someone's educated and smart doesn't mean you can always trust everything they say. But this fella is not that ignorant, unsophisticated, unlearned person that sometimes the critics of the Bible would have us believe all who believe in the Bible are. Says this among the many things he said. He says to be skeptical of the text of the New Testament books is to allow all of classical antiquity to slip into obscurity. For no documents of the ancient period are as well attested bibliographically as the New Testament. This was from his book called History and Christianity, because he's considered a prominent scholar on the subject of history, among other things. What he's saying is that the kind of test that is often put to the New Testament and is argued that we can't trust it would mean there's practically nothing we can know about what happened in history more than just 100 or so years ago, and especially ancient history. Anything you want to know about the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans, forget it. There's not enough documentation of the right kind, according to these critics, for us to know anything about them either, because if we apply the same test they seem to want to apply to our New Testament documents, that would be the case. Very valuable little book. I wish every Christian would own a copy of it. It's by a man by the name of F.F. Bruce, called The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? It's one of the books we use in our Tanglewood Bible Institute course when we get to probably Ed Wharton's Historical Christian Evidences course. This is my original first copy. Back then, it only cost $1.50 retail. This book was originally written in 1943 by Dr. Bruce. Dr. Bruce passed away in 1990. He was considered a Greek scholar and a scholar in history and ancient documentation and documents. Again, just like Professor Montgomery, we just mentioned, a prominent professor for many years in more than one university in England. And in this little book, he talks about this whole subject of whether these documents that we call our New Testament hold up well when examined in the same way we examine other documents from history. And so he says in his preface here, he says concerning this, he says, when the first edition of this book appeared in 1943, I was a lecturer in classical studies and had for long been accustomed to view the New Testament in its classical context. In other words, at that time, he mostly talked in his courses at the university to his students about just looking at the New Testament the same way we look at other ancient classical documents. And when I was invited from time to time to address audiences of sixth formers and university students on the trustworthiness of the New Testament in general and of the gospel records in particular, my usual line was to show that the grounds for accepting the New Testament as trustworthy compared very favorably with the grounds on which classical students accepted the authenticity and credibility of many ancient documents. And it was out of such talks that this book originally grew. Where he's heading with that, he says, even from the beginning, he argued that the New Testament was at least a well attested to in terms of its reliability and accuracy and historical record as any other classical. Where he's headed with that, though, is saying, as he studied on that more, and by the time he comes out with his second edition, which this one is, he became ever more convinced of the truth of that. He says, but the amount of evidence available in our own day is so much greater and more conclusive that a first century date for most of the New Testament writings cannot reasonably be denied, no matter what our philosophical presuppositions must be. And he will say, the conclusion that these New Testament documents aren't reliable and aren't from the first century, this conclusion was not the result so much of historical evidence on the part of the critics as of their philosophical presuppositions. He says, somehow or other, there are people who regard a sacred book as ipso facto under suspicion and demand much more corroborative evidence for such a work than they would for any ordinary secular or pagan writing. And we do not quarrel with those who want more evidence for the New Testament than for other writings. Firstly, because the universal claims which the New Testament makes upon mankind are so absolute, and the character and works of its chief figure so unparalleled, that we want to be as sure of its truth as we possibly can. And secondly, because in point of fact, there is much more evidence for the New Testament than for any other ancient writings of comparable date. You know, the Apostle Paul often reasoned with people as he tried to teach them the gospel. And here's a little point of reasoning for us this morning. I was just doing a little looking up last night concerning Julius Caesar. Do you know who Julius Caesar was? I mean, I know he's not a personal friend of yours, but, you know, to the ancient Romans, Julius Caesar was the father of their nation. He was a great general who lived, he was born in 100 B.C. and rose up through the ranks of the army at the time when it wasn't the Roman Empire, it was the Roman Republic. It was much smaller than it came to be. But he rose up to be a general and won great battles and great wars on behalf of his nation, and soon moved from the field of the military into politics, and so went on to be a statesman and even a consul for the nation at a time when their nation, the Republic, was run by the Senate, of these group of men who were the Senate, and they would select one as a consul who would sort of serve as the prime minister, is probably a word we'd use today in some nations to fit that. And he went on to be a consul for a time, serving as a triumvirate, three men together serving in that regard. And then after divisions among themselves and civil wars, as people took sides, finally he arose victorious as the one and only consul of the Roman Republic. And then he guided the Senate and their nation to move from being a republic to an empire, and going from having a consul to having an empire. Now, maybe we don't think that's so great, but from a historical standpoint for the Romans, that was the point in time that turned to made them into the great empire that existed for so long. We know concerning him that he was assassinated. A group of the senators who wanted to stay with the old republic form of government, in which they had much more power, in which the consul had a lot less power, consulted together and schemed and devised together under one of the senators by the name of Brutus, and they assassinated him on the 15th of March in 44 B.C. And whether it's really history or whether it's just Shakespeare, we don't know, but even as Caesar is lying, dying on the marble pavement, he looks up and sees this man that was once his good friend and says, "E tu, Brute?" In other words, "You too, Brutus, have conspired against me." But in spite of his death, the ball had started rolling and it couldn't be stopped. And it went on then to have a large number of emperors and a great effect on that part of the world for hundreds and hundreds of years. That's Julius Caesar. Well, how do we actually know anything about this man? This is long before the days of modern television, radio, newspapers, reporters, technology, and all that kind of thing. How do we know about him today? What's the records we have? The records we have concerning him fall mostly into four categories. First of all, some writings he did himself called the Gallic Wars, in which he kept sort of a running diary of some of his conquests back when he was a general instead of an emperor. And these books, I think there were eight volumes, as they counted volumes back then, wouldn't compare to our modern book volumes, but eight volumes of these books called the Gallic Wars, a large portion of them no longer exists. We don't have any copies at all. Or at least we don't have a portion of some of them, maybe not a large portion, but a portion of them we don't have any copies at all. And the earliest copy we have of the Gallic Wars that has so far been discovered by a man who wrote them probably around 50 B.C., is a copy that was made by someone in 900 A.D., 950 years after his original, which we don't have, and any copies that were made after that time. And as an emperor, you know, anything he wrote would have been considered valuable, and so would have been every effort would have been made to preserve it. But over hundreds of years, finally, the earliest copy we actually have is one made in 900 A.D. Is it reliable? Can we depend on it? Is it possible that people changed it, rewrote it, edited it, put in all sorts of fictional stuff, left out all sort of true stuff? All that's possible. But show me the scholar who believes that. You won't find one. They all totally trust the Gallic Wars, a copy we have made 950 years after the original, as being essentially a trustworthy, accurate historical record of what Caesar did in his Gallic Wars. For it was in the Gallic Wars he's recording how he conquered what today is France and part of Spain, and even crossed the English Channel and began to conquer Great Britain. Went north and crossed the Rhine River and started trying to conquer part of Germany. And he's given credit for all those things in history. Second source of information concerning him was by a contemporary of his, by a man by the name of Cicero, a senator, a speechwriter, gave great speeches himself, sometimes even wrote some, I think, for Julius Caesar to make, wrote a large number of letters to other people. At least there's some indication that he did. His life was pretty contemporary with Julius Caesar's. His most prominent two books were called On the Republic and On the Laws, in which he talked about the history of the Republic in his time, and in which he talked about both the laws that they had and their government and the laws that were being changed as they transfigured into an empire from a republic. None of his originals exist. For a long time, all we had were just quotations of his books in the writings of others at later times. Finally, just recently, they have found a copy of his On the Republic that was made somewhere around A.D. 350, 400 years, this copy is, after when he originally wrote. And yet he's one of the four primary sources of information we have about Julius Caesar. Then there was a historian who lived and wrote around A.D. 120, a man by the name of Suetonius. And what was so significant about Suetonius is, first of all, he worked directly under the emperor at that time named Hadrian. And Hadrian had either encouraged or actually commissioned Suetonius to write a history of the emperors up until that time. That had 12, starting with Julius Caesar, and then 11 more after them up until Hadrian. And so he wrote a book that is appropriately called The 12 Caesars. And it covered the life and rule of Julius Caesar as well as those that came after him, Augustus and so forth. Now, we don't have the originals. The copies we have are missing the first few chapters of the section on Julius Caesar. And so we don't even have all of what he wrote, must have written about Julius Caesar. It is believed that because he was in a government position and under the direct blessing of the emperor at that time, he had access to the archives of the government so he could verify and support anything he wrote in these documents. And yet all those archives are gone. None of them exist. And the earliest copy we have of his The 12 Caesars is from 958, 850 years after he wrote. We don't have the originals. We don't have the first copies from those originals. We probably have the copies of the copies of the copies of the copies, who knows how many. And yet everyone trusts what Suetonius wrote. Similar story with another historian named Plutarch. Lived at the same period of time, wrote another book that involved Julius Caesar in part of it, in which he was comparing Julius Caesar as a great Roman with a great Greek historical figure from a previous generation, along with others that he would do the same thing with, comparing Romans to Greeks, in which he didn't even try to document what they historically did, but rather just talked about their personal character and their moral character and what ideas and what good things they brought to the public and introduced into their culture because of their character and nature as people, not what they actually did. And so here's our almost a sum total of all the accurate records, if accurate they are, of Julius Caesar. His own writings on the Gallic Wars, which the earliest copy we have is 950 years after he wrote the originals. Some writings of Cicero, a contemporary of his, the earliest copy of which we have is 400 years after the original was written. The history of Suetonius, a man who lived 150 years after Julius Caesar and so was not an eyewitness and had access to no eyewitnesses as he wrote, and in which he doesn't even tell us what his real sources were for what he writes. And the earliest copy we have of what he wrote is 850 years after he wrote it. And then Plutarch, who doesn't even write a history concerning Julius Caesar, but just something about his personal character and nature and values and so forth, whose writings have disappeared except much later copies just like all these others. Can we then believe there really was a Julius Caesar? Can we believe he really reigned over the Roman Empire and began the empire? Can we believe the things that are sometimes written in our history books about him as a great general and so forth? Can we even believe he died on the 15th of March, 44 B.C.? You cannot find the historian anywhere who would deny any of that. And yet the records we have that make up our New Testament are much better than that. We don't have four sources. Just within the pages of our New Testament, we have 27. Realize these books were all written separately, not originally just as one volume like we have it bound together today. We have the majority of these people, well, all of them who claim either to have known Jesus personally, like Matthew, Mark, John, Peter, Jude, or who have lived in the same generation when Jesus did, and so had easy access to all those people who did know him, like Paul and Luke. And while we don't have their originals either, the earliest copies we have start showing up only 100 years after the original. Not 900, not 800, not even 450 like with Cicero's stuff. And while even as we talk about, for example, Cicero's stuff, AD 350 as opposed to 50 BC when he wrote it, some 400 years later or so, we just have one copy. Just one of the New Testament documents we have, depending on when you want to do the cutoff. If you want to do the cutoff up there where they are for Julius Caesar around 900 AD or 950 AD, we have over 5,000 copies of one or more of the New Testament books by 900 AD. Reliable? Trustworthy? If any documents from ancient history are reliable, these documents are on that basis. They're all of first century origin. They either were written by eyewitnesses or by those who had access to the eyewitnesses. So we have better evidence just on this one basis for believing these documents accurately reflect what actually happened and what was actually said than any others in existence for any other historical character or event of history from that time or earlier or even most times later. So what? Our confidence can be secure. In spite of the loud shouting by the critics, in spite of the often accusations about the copying and unreliability and changes in editing that they outright claim falsely has taken place with these documents, It's not true. Only changes that took place were those that were almost always inadvertently came into existence as people were trying to make copies and maybe would, as I said, misspell a word, accidentally leave out a word, especially a minor word like an a, an, or a the, or an adjective or something. Or perhaps occasionally would substitute a different word because over time some words fell out of use in the Greek language and so in other words came in that meant about the same thing, so they would sometimes substitute a different word in those later copies in place of an original one. But accuracy, yes. Historical, yes. Eyewitness records, yes. Jesus really lived. He did these things. He said these things. Our faith is built on solid evidence. And that's what we'd want it to be, not blind faith. So, well, we'll continue with some other things next. Our faith is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. Good reason to be so. When people are given the opportunity to examine these kind of evidences for themselves, they often change greatly their view of these. It's amazing how many men I run across in my reading and books I have and other books even being published who were once atheists and unbelievers and had believed all these accusations and false claims until they actually took the time for themselves. And they changed. Changed so dramatically that many of them became professing believers and Christians. And even those who didn't greatly moderated their viewpoint on whether or not this is reliable history or not.